This is Like It Is, today an encore recording featuring Tony Award winner Melba Moore.
I'm privileged today with me here at the Hyatt Regency Hotel is Tony Award winner Melba Moore. Thank you, Ms. Moore, for being a guest today on Like It Is.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about why you're in town, first off. Why?
Well, I'm in Houston for the run for the rest of the week of Mama, I'm Sorry, the gospel music of musical of which I am the star, along with Kenny Holiday, formerly of Matlock and Carter Country, G2 Kumbuka, AJ Johnson, Ronnie Wilson, formerly of the Gap Band, Eric Dawkins of Dawkins and Dawkins, Isaac Curie, formerly of John P. Key, etc. David Peaston.
Okay, you don't want to leave out any. We don't want to leave out anyone. Let's talk about Songs My Mother Taught Me, the one-woman production.
Songs My Mother Taught Me is an autobiographical one-woman play that I mounted, and that's in development that I hope will be my project to follow Mama, I'm Sorry. Mama, I'm Sorry is booked through the spring of 1996, and so it is my hope that during the hiatus months, Mama, I'm Sorry, that we will be developing Songs My Mother Taught Me. We have a hiatus in June, July, and August, and also in December and January. So in those 2 months, I'll be hopefully finishing that project, and then we finish the run of Mama, I'm Sorry.
I'm sorry. Why did you feel it necessary to undertake those projects that you just mentioned?
Songs My Mother Taught Me was written because I found myself divorced in a way that I did not participate in through a fraudulent divorce, which I didn't know about. But by the time I did find out about it, I also realized that I had been blackballed, that I was destitute, bankrupt, eventually had to apply for welfare assistance. And the only thing that I had was my life, the music that was still in my possession, because I didn't have money to buy charts or to get arrangements or do anything new. So I determined I would start with what I have, which is me. So I began to construct my autobiography in a stand-up cabaret form, starting with what it was like to be the child of a traveling singer mother, single mother, and go back and use some of the charts that I had, say like Don't Mean a Thing. What else did I had? Old things like Blue Skies, old classic songs that I had done over the years that people loved, but I gave them an order and created a story out of that, and I eventually got that on videotape and got some people interested in developing it into, helping me to develop it into a full play, but it really was out of survival.
Mm-hmm. We want to talk about survival, and you mentioned blackball, that you were blackballed. My guest today is Tony Award winner, Melba Moore.
If you're ever away from your favorite radio station, you can find Like It Is on the NV1 app for Apple and Android.
Ms. Moore, you mentioned a few minutes ago about being blackballed. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that in terms of how that happened and what brought that about?
Oh, well, what brought it about was that my ex-husband, Charles Huggins, and I began an organization called Hush Productions many years ago, shortly after our marriage, which we founded together to manage me and to eventually manage people like Freddie Jackson, Alex Mignon, Melissa Morgan, Kashif, a series of people, and a variety of other enterprises that continues on today. And some point, I found myself the victim of a conspiracy by my ex-husband, Mr. Huggins, and a woman by the name of Ann Thomas, who together, of course, unbeknownst to me, forged documents and carried out a fraudulent series of negotiations with an attorney by the name of Brian Golden out of Pennsylvania to divorce me without my knowledge or consent. And through that process, transfer any ownership or partnership participation I might have had in marital assets and business assets over to Charles. And I would not have had any way to fight that, because by the time I found out about it, it had been done, with the exception that they forgot to mention in this fraudulent divorce that Charles and I had a daughter. Through that loophole, I was able to countersue first for her custody, we have a daughter, and then to renegotiate, overturn the fraudulent divorce, or set it aside, and have a new divorce, which was done in New York State. But that one was done under such duress. By that time, I was destitute. I had no ability to pay for legal advice. I didn't really know what had happened to me because it had been done without my knowledge or participation. So what I had to do was try to get some spousal support because he didn't have to pay me anything. The fraudulent divorce made it seem as though I didn't want any alimony. I didn't want any of our assets, that I was just fine the way I was. But of course, I was destitute, and I didn't have a legal counsel. I didn't know about it, so there was nothing I could do to contest it until after the fact. But by the time I was in the position to know that it happened, I was really pressed, and I was under a lot of physical and psychological abuse from my husband, and didn't realize until a little bit later, when I really had to actively get up and try to go out and get work for myself, that not only was it coming from him, but he had poisoned the industry. And I began to get reports back of myself being a crack addict, a religious fanatic, a lesbian, difficult to get along with. And I have these things in documentation now. Now I've gone through the process to find out exactly what happened to me. And it was under these circumstances that I eventually made a counter divorce agreement, of which he breached. He paid a little bit of the alimony support, and he paid a little bit of the child support, and then he stopped doing that. And I went to family court. I did a series of things, but up to this date, he has not paid one penny of anything. He has all of our assets. Just about 2 days ago, he through my daughter, made an offer to give me our office building at 231 West 58th Street, which is the headquarters of Hush Productions. And it's the first asset that we bought and started our business with. And I think that's because he realizes that I have to have my life back. And thank God, because I do have Mama, I'm Sorry. And I have many, many people who are praying and care about what happens to me, that he's not going to make people forget about me. He's not going to keep me from telling the truth. So at this point, I'm facing a jail sentence, which the Supreme Court, State Supreme Court Judge Elliot Wilk in New York, has sentenced me to sing in the prison. He said he didn't think there was any real point in punishing me, and he basically really knows the surrounding facts of how myself and my daughter have been abused, and that the fact is I should have been bringing charges against him, but I didn't have the ability to, both because the agreement said I had no right to sue him and because I didn't have the financial ability to sue him. But fortunately, because I disobeyed the gag order, mm-hmm. Charles has sued me, and of course we're in front of the courts and the media with this whole issue being brought out.
Is it good to discuss some of the points that you've just discussed?
I think it's wonderful.
And so this is public record and public knowledge, public information.
Yes, all of what I'm saying I've said many, many, many times before, which is why I'm going to jail. And my contention is that if Mr. Huggins and Ms. Thomas want me to stop saying these things about them, and if they're so bad, then they need to do some good things so I can say good things about them, such as return my property, admit that you forged documents, restore what you stole from me, and let's end this. If that's not going to be the case, then I know from my experience that if I don't remain public, I might wind up in an alley somewhere and you wouldn't know what happened to me, because that's what happened essentially when I got an attorney and my ex-husband found out that I was going to contest the divorce. He came to our home and he physically assaulted me. So there's no way I'm going to stop talking.
So,
I mean, as long as good people like you will listen to me.
In terms of all of what has happened, has this angered you, or has it more awakened you to reality, or how does it make you feel?
So many different feelings at different times. Certainly very, very hurt and very crushed that people who pretended to be your family and your loved ones and your black brother and your black sister, they didn't even hate you. They didn't care that much about you. because, you know, you thought, well, why did you hate me so much? Why did you hurt me? What did I do to you? It really wasn't about that. The reason I know that, Bob, is because I found documents that go way, 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 way back to the beginning of our relationship that proved to me that this was a conspiracy from the beginning, and that they picked me out feeling that I was a humble person, an honest person, a loyal person, a faithful person, one who had a good reputation that they could hide behind.
You mentioned family. Let's talk about, you're from a musical family. Let's talk about the role of your parents in your present musical career, how they helped to shape that. Your family, your mom and your dad were associated with musical greats Ella Fitzgerald, Dizzy Gillespie, Sarah Vaughan, Carmen McRae, and Count Basie. Did that have an effect or a molding effect on you and your career?
Looking back on it, I'm absolutely sure it did. I didn't have really any music in my life per se in the early years up until the time I was 9 years old, because I was raised by a wonderful woman from the backwoods of South Carolina who never learned to read or write, and she wasn't musical, and she was a nanny, and she, you know, raised me. And my mother was away. And at that time, she was a single parent. She was not married to my natural father, who was also a musician. She has since passed away, and so has my natural father. But at 9 years old, she married my stepfather. And he's still living, and he's a fine musician. And he comes from a family that cares about morals, values, education, family life, family structure. And that's where I was blessed to have that intervention. And when my mother married him, he had a son and a daughter. And he made us all take piano lessons. And I took dance, and my sister took art as well. He made us all study and get a discipline. And I think that is where the greatest influence came. And then, of course, when you began to hear all the wonderful music around you that they loved, and see the glamorous colleagues that they had, it had a very euphoric, romantic influence on me. And I think this just devastated me. It was a combination of those things that really impacted upon me committing myself to continuing to study music and then to get a degree in education. And I didn't teach very long because I really had a strong urge to be an artist. But certainly those things impacted very strongly.
Do you have a favorite musical number that you like to sing or hum when you're happy? And do you have a favorite one when you're sad? Would you share that with our audience, please?
Well, I don't know if I have a favorite one when I'm happy or sad. I'm not so sure. I think when I'm if I'm unhappy, I'm usually pensive and I'm thinking. It's usually if I'm really joyful, I'll pop up with some kind of a song. And it doesn't necessarily have to be one particular song, but my most inspired type of music always seems to come from Mahalia Jackson. Mm. I love the sound of her voice when I can't even understand what she's saying. Like, for instance, which is one of these mornings, soon in the morning, I'm going to lay down my cross, get me a crown. Late one evening, soon in the evening, I'm going home, live with God. I mean, I like those words. I like the way her voice sounds, and I particularly like it when I'm in a bathtub and you can hear the echo.
I even think I can sing in the bathroom.
You know, it's like
but you
that.
You can.
But it's really like, it's not like about how well you sing. It really is about how it feels and maybe what thoughts you have about the person who has sung it and how much you love how they sing and how they interpret the insights that you get from thinking about the lyrics and what they might have meant, and you know how God inspired her, and why was she so so strongly adamant about just singing sacred music, and why is Mahalia Jackson such an icon? I mean, you know, yes, we all know about her, but when you hear her music and you hum it, and you say, "How come my voice won't do that?" You know, all of those things are. Well, the answer to your question. If I'm sad or concerned about something, I think generally there's no musicality, because I guess I'm communing with the Holy Spirit and asking Him, well, what's going on? There's a problem. I'm speaking. I'm thinking. I'm probing, but I'm not singing.
Who influenced your musical career most? Who would you attribute influencing you the most in your musical career?
Well, I guess really in terms of listening to music and trying to be in tune and feel what music is, it would have been mostly musicians, maybe because my dad made me aware of music through an instrument first. And I can remember being told that I had a pretty voice and this and that and the other, and there was some to-do made over it, but it seemed that my attention was never so much on singing and singers as it was on instrumentalists. So I love jazz an awful lot. I love blues. I love gospel, you know. And of course, there's always, you know, the pop thing that kind of pervades everything. So, you know, it's usually so successful you can't really avoid it. So, I mean, you're going to hear about Frank Sinatra or Johnny Mathis or Barry Manilow. I mean, even if that's not what kind of music you're into, and it's good music.
Bob Franklin here. The program you're listening to is Like It Is, a radio public affairs presentation. Today, I'm on location in Houston, Texas. My guest is Tony Award winner Melba Moore. She's been talking very candidly about some of the things that have impacted her life and some of the things that she'll be doing in the not-too-distant future. We will be talking about that shortly. But I want to talk about another medium, television, that you've had a successful career in. Television and its portrayal of African-Americans. Do you believe it's good acting, good writing, and good themes and plots, or a combination of all of the above, that keeps Fox's television program Martin on the air versus former Fox series Rock that was canceled? You have a point of view on that?
Well, you assume that I watch a lot of TV. I don't.
Oh, that's a bad assumption on my part.
But I certainly have a good deal of experience in television. And I would say that African Americans are certainly learning the politics of good entrepreneurship and good business. And I think that's the secret of success, regardless of what racism there is going on. Sometimes it's more difficult because of racism in politics. But those who get the formula right will succeed. For instance, Kayla Kowloon, Bill Cosby's been successful. That's understanding and repeating the success process again and again. Look at myself. Obviously, I'm talented, you know, whatever. But I've been sporadic in these areas. And what my hope is that I will learn some of the basics, or I have learned, especially through these last experiences, of what the ABCs are of getting in, and then how you get better as you stay, both in what your material is, and you have the subject matter is important, the personality that it's hooked on are important, and of course what time it is and what people are ready for and what they need at that time and what they will accept at that time. I'm saying all these things, and it seems like it's an awful lot for you to be sensitive to, but that's really what happens, and you'll see why. Certain times, like now, and I think it's going to continue, there's a profusion of African Americans and everything, and I think that art still is reflective of the culture, and that is because African Americans not going to be the bottom of the rung anymore. First of all, we've been out of slavery long enough for a few of us to really get the point that there has been a concerted effort to keep you out, and it's not just you, it's whoever's in power is not going to give it to anybody, and that's understandable.
The point I wanted to make in comparing Martin, which is a comedian type of it's a comedy versus Rock, which dealt with more serious material, was the fact that it appears that dramatic series about African Americans and their problems seem not to last very long on network television, as opposed to the comedies that we see. We go way back to Paris.
You know what? You might be right, but I don't agree. I think that Martin is another Eddie Murphy. He's an unusual, brilliant, talented person who understands what his media is, and he's charismatic. He sticks out. You know, there are probably a lot of shows that come and go, and Martin will still be there. That's my opinion.
Do you think it sends, since television is perception more than reality, do you think it sends the type of message that need to be sent in terms of the type of African-Americans who are being portrayed and the way they're being portrayed on television?
Well, I think yes. I mean, there's a variety of us to be portrayed, and I think one of the good things about the fact is that there's going to continue to be a profusion of African Americans portrayed is you will have a variety of people portrayed, and people will have more and more choices. As we go back in time, you can see there were less and less and fewer and fewer. And of course, we were less accurately portrayed, because if you're going to be portrayed at all, you had to understand the political system, and that's understandable. I mean, people got a lot of flack for doing whatever they did at certain times because it wasn't representative, but the people who were in power were interested in representing you, and you still had to get in there somehow. That's my view of it, and that you can compare Rock with Martin, and you will have other shows you can compare, Prince of Bel-Air, and, you know, I don't watch very much, like I'm saying, but a variety of other things that are on. You'll have the video shows, you'll have the recording artists. I think you're going to see lots and lots and lots more of art that represents sacred music and art, because there's a whole lot of us, and we have not at all begun to press the envelope as far as our rightful place in the commercial world.
And you do that by getting in boardrooms, on in decision-making positions at the network?
First, what you do is, if you're in entertainment, you do something that succeeds, like Mama, I'm Sorry, and like Mike Matthews, and you create a formula in an arena where you can develop, where you can make mistakes, with a supportive base, which is your own backyard, which for Mama, I'm Sorry, is a church base, African-American grassroots to middle-class audiences. It's a wide base. We appeal to a big volume of people, which means that we can make money. We don't command ridiculous salaries, which means we can make a profit. We all want to do what we do, so we're anxious to teach and make jobs and internships and workshops out of it. So it's going to prosper within itself as an entrepreneurial entity. And as it continues to prosper and it continues to stay there season after season after season with a variety of things that people want and see, it's commercially viable. So then the institutions, wherever they are going to start to look to see, well, gee, that's the new thing on the block, or how can we be a part of that, or can we translate that to television? How is that? It's music, so can we sell records with it? So it blossoms into a variety of areas. That's my view.
The family unit, our next point. What was the most lasting lesson you learned from your parents, and what makes it lasting to you?
Perhaps something I'm reminded of in Mama, I'm Sorry, honor your father and your mother. Perhaps the thing that makes it lasting to me is that I'm a parent now. another thing being, now that time has passed, you can go back and remember how violent, in some cases, truly it was impressed upon me, with strictness and sometimes ignorance, and yet in some other ways with great intelligence and wisdom and love and sweetness and kindness. And then in other ways, it wasn't impressed at all, and you were left on your own to do whatever it is you want to do. Maybe get some distance, or maybe totally forget about it, you know. And then you have an opportunity to look at it as something people say. Look at it as a law that God commanded, that if we did this, he would reward us with long life. He would give us a land filled with milk and honey. He would make us leaders, strong, healthy. We would be void of disease and plagues, essentially. I mean, something to think about. And perhaps something to test to see if it's really true and if it really works. And there are others, but that's one that comes to mind right now.
Many people stand in attention when they hear the Negro National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing. Tell me a little bit about your feelings about that particular song.
Well, first of all, it wasn't my idea to do it many years ago. It was my ex-husband's idea, which is one example of how wonderfully brilliant he was and how much really good he did in terms of being a good husband, a good father, and good manager. He had wonderful ideas, and for the right reason, for the right purpose. For a variety of reasons, we never actually did it. And in 1991, I determined it's time to do it. I'd done a lot of philanthropic work, and I was with Capitol Records, and the Winans would just become very, very popular. And I thought, wow, B.B. Winans is on my leg. B.B. is just, let me ask and see if that would work. And everybody thought it was a fabulous idea. And once B.B. and I got together, and he did a wonderful arrangement of it, and we garnered all the different artists and did it. Then I took it to Dr. C. Dolores Tucker and Dr. Dorothy Hite. Dr. Tucker's of the National Political Congress of Black Women, and Dr. Hite is the president of the National Council of Negro Women. And she had made me a national chair for the membership, and I'd been that for about 4 or 5 years. And with their collective efforts and a variety of other wonderful Congress people, we thought it was a great idea that after 90 years of being in existence as our anthem or our hymn, that we would enter it into the congressional record and make it official. And so it's down in the history books, not in the history books yet, but it's down in historical record as the official African American national anthem.
My guest today has been Tony Award winner Melba Moore. Ms. Moore, it's been my privilege and my pleasure to spend these moments talking with you today on Like It Is. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Today's program was a rebroadcast featuring Tony Award winner Melba Moore.
If you ever find yourself away from your favorite radio station, you can find this episode of Like It Is and many more on your favorite podcast app. I want to thank listeners who have kept Like It Is on air for 30 years. I'm here for you, and I want to hear from you. Send me a message on www.greenthumbfoundationinc.com. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.